to hold in check the disposition of the other to tyrannize over other nations. Anthony Mary never warmed to Jefferson, and the British diplomat followed any whisper of American discontent. Jefferson's popularity was such, he was renominated by the Republican Congressional Caucus in February 1804 for a second term as president, that Federalist concern was turning into desperation. On Saturday, February 11, 1804, Senator Timothy Pickering sat down in Washington to lament the sorry state of things in the age of Jefferson. Federal judges and other office holders were under assault. The Jefferson-led mob ruled. "And must we submit to these evils?" Pickering wrote the Massachusetts Federalist Theodore Lyman. "Is there no remedy?" Secession, Pickering believed, could be the one way to resist the torrent of Jefferson's government. Massachusetts was thought to be the most likely leader. If she went, then Connecticut would, followed by New Hampshire, Rhode Island, and Vermont. If New York were convinced, it would be the center of the new nation. She would surely join, he said, which could, in turn, bring along New Jersey and Pennsylvania east of the Susquehanna. And Britain. Britain would probably agree to let parts of its North America holdings join forces with a Northern Union. In theory, it all seems so reasonable. It is not unusual for two friends, when disagreeing about the mode of conducting a common concern, to separate and manage each in his own way his separate interest, and thereby preserve a useful friendship which, without such separation, would infallibly be destroyed, Pickering said. Pickering's vision probably meant civil war. Why would Jefferson's party let the North go? Another Pickering correspondent, Massachusetts Federalist George Cabot, thought the hour for separation was not yet at hand, but was open to finding the right one. "We are democratic altogether, and I hold democracy in its natural operation to be the government of the worst," Cabot wrote Pickering. Pickering was adamant. "I am disgusted with the men who now rule us, and with their measures," he wrote on the third anniversary of Jefferson's inauguration. Pickering was putting much faith in reports that Burr might try to become governor of New York, which would, he hoped, provide a counterweight to Virginia. Jefferson would then be forced to observe some caution and forbearance in his measures, Pickering said. The Federalist view, according to a correspondent of Rufus King's, was that the shortest and beaten road of tyranny is that which leads through democracy. King was no disunionist, but he said that Pickering's letter ought to fix the attention of the real friends of liberty in this quarter of the Union, and the more so as things seemed to be fast advancing to a crisis. Rumors of disunion persisted for several years. Anthony Mary heard them and reported them to London. The British diplomat Augustus J. Foster wrote about them to his mother. "The possibility of a division is even openly talked of in the public papers, and recriminations are exchanged between the eastern and southern states," he wrote in June 1805. Then there was Aaron Burr, an elusive and daunting political force. On Thursday, January 26, 1804, Burr called on Jefferson at the president's house. After the Electoral College tie of 1800-1801, the two men had had little contact in the first term, and Jefferson was determined to keep him off the ballot in 1804. As Burr told his story, he cast himself in the warmest and best of lights. He was saying, the humblest and most honest of men. Burr knew he was under attack publicly and privately. Jefferson reported that Burr had said many little stories had been carried to him, and he supposed to me also, which he despised, but that attachments must be reciprocal or cease to exist, and therefore he asked if any change had taken place in mind towards him, that he had chosen to have this conversation with myself directly, and not through any intermediate agent. Burr was willing to stand down, he said, but to do so he needed Jefferson's help, an appointment of some kind. Jefferson's reply was maddening. The president disclaimed any role in electioneering. He said he could do nothing for Burr. Meanwhile, the proposed 12th Amendment was making its way through the states. The amendment was designed to prevent any future electoral crisis by separating the ballots for president and vice president, meaning that there could be no more ties between candidates who were putatively running as a ticket. that great opposition is and will be made by Federalists to this amendment is certain, Jefferson wrote Thomas McCain in January 1804. They know that if it prevails, neither a president or vice president can ever be made but by the fair vote of the majority of the nation, of which they are not. A fire had devastated Norfolk, Virginia. Jefferson sent $200 for the relief of the poor sufferers, but asked to remain anonymous. At Edge Hill, Polly gave birth to a daughter on Wednesday, February 15th. 1,000 joys to you, my dear Maria, on the happy accession to your family, Jefferson wrote on Sunday, February 26, 1804, using the name Polly had taken for herself in November 1789. But all was not well. Polly was not recovering. Her husband, John Wales Epps, left Washington for home. It was a difficult journey, complicated by high winds and ice. I feel dreadfully apprehensive that the great debility under which she labors may terminate in some serious complaint, Epps wrote Jefferson. In the Mediterranean, on the last day of October 1803, the U.S. frigate Philadelphia had been captured by Tripolitan forces. 3.5 months later, in the middle of February 1804, Commodore Stephen Decatur led a courageous expedition to destroy the Philadelphia in order to keep it from being turned against the United States. In British Vice Admiral Horatio Nelson's view, Decatur's mission was the most bold and daring act of the age, and Jefferson struck the same notes in his remarks on the episode. In general, I am mortified at the consternation which most of our public agents abroad have manifested at the loss of the Philadelphia, Jefferson wrote Madison in April 1804. It seems as if they thought on the loss of one frigate that everything was lost. This must humble us in the eyes of Europe, and renders it the more indispensable to inflict on Tripoli the same chastisement of which the two most powerful nations of Europe have given the world repeated examples. Jefferson left Washington on Sunday, April 1, 1804, for Monticello. When he arrived 3 days later, he discovered Polly in much worse condition than he had anticipated. He immediately took charge of her care. In a rare instance of understatement, Jefferson told Madison that things were not all they could be. "Our spring is remarkably uncheery," Jefferson wrote Madison on Friday, April 13th, Jefferson's 61st birthday. As Polly grew worse, Jefferson wrote to Dearborn, Gallatin, and Madison, trying to turn his mind, if only for the briefest of moments, to business. It did not work. On a question about Spanish duties at Mobile, Jefferson told Dearborn that Polly's distressing situation disables me from forming any opinion on the subject. On Tuesday, April 17, 1804, Polly died. "How the president will get over this blow, I cannot pronounce," Thomas Mann Randolph, Jr. wrote Caesar A. Rodney. "He passed all last evening with his handkerchief in his hand. Adieu. I begin to feel the want of mine." Dolly Madison learned the news directly from Jefferson. A letter from the president announced the death of poor Polly and the consequent misery it has occasioned them all. "This is among the many proofs of the uncertainty of life," Mrs. Madison wrote her sister. "A girl so young, so lovely. All the efforts of her father, doctors, and friends availed nothing." Exhausted and grieving, Jefferson returned to Washington. "I arrived here last night after the most fatiguing journey I have experienced for a great many years," Jefferson wrote Patsy, now his last surviving child with his late wife, from Washington on May 14th. On Saturday, June 2nd, an unexpected letter arrived at the president's house from Quincy, Massachusetts. "It has been some time since that I conceived of any event in this life which could call forth feelings of mutual sympathy," wrote Abigail Adams. "But I know how closely entwined around a parent's heart are those cords which bind the filial to the parental bosom, and when snapped asunder, how agonizing the pangs of separation." Jefferson replied, politely, and the brief correspondence touched on the things that had come to divide Jefferson and the Adamses: calendars vicious, prospect before us, and the midnight appointments. Abigail Adams wrote him again on Sunday, July 1st, explaining the source of her deepest anger toward Jefferson. "I have never felt any enmity towards you, sir, for being elected President of the United States. but the instruments made use of, and the means which were practiced to effect a change, have my utter abhorrence and detestation, for they were the blackest calumny and foulest falsehoods. I had witnessed enough of the anxiety and solicitude, the envy, jealousy, and reproach attendant upon the office, as well as the high responsibility of the station, to be perfectly willing to see a transfer of it. Now, sir, I will freely disclose to you what has severed the bonds of former friendship and placed you in a light very different from what I once viewed you in. One of the first acts of your administration was to liberate a wretch who was suffering the just punishment of the law due to his crimes for writing and publishing the basest libel, the lowest and vilest slander which malice could invent or calumny exhibit against the character and reputation of your predecessor, of him for whom you profess the highest esteem and friendship, and whom you certainly knew incapable of such complicated baseness. The remission of Callender's fine was a public approbation of his conduct. Is not the last restraint of vice a sense of shame rendered abortive if abandoned characters do not excite abhorrence? The serpent you cherished and warmed bit the hand that nourished him, and gave you sufficient specimens of his talents, his gratitude, his justice, and his truth. This letter is written in confidence. No eye but my own has seen what has passed. Faithful are the wounds of a friend. Often have I wished to have seen a different course pursued by you. I bear no malice, I cherish no enmity. I would not retaliate if I could. Nay, more, in the true spirit of Christian charity, I would forgive, as I hope to be forgiven. Jefferson replied on Sunday, July 22nd, claiming that his support of Callender had been based on opposition to the sedition laws and his agreement with the writer's politics at the time. My charities to him were no more meant as encouragements to his scurrilities than those I give to the beggar at my door are meant as rewards for the vices of his life. Jefferson and Abigail held such starkly different views of the events of the last decade or so that despite the exchange of a total of 7 letters from May to October 1804, it became clear further conversation was pointless. The exchange ended as suddenly as it had begun. John Adams learned of it only after it came to a close in the autumn of 1804. On Wednesday, July 11th, 1804, in Weehawken, New Jersey, high above the Hudson River, the Vice President of the United States shot the First Secretary of the Treasury dead in a duel, fought over allegedly disparaging remarks Alexander Hamilton had made about Aaron Burr. Jefferson left only the most cursory allusions to Hamilton's death. There was no testimonial, no letter of tribute to a friend that Jefferson expected to reach the newspapers. His silence at the time, the middle of 1804, seems odd, even ungracious. The politics of the moment may help explain why Jefferson held his tongue and his pen on the subject. The public reaction to Hamilton's death was intense and emotional. He was eulogized as the greatest and most virtuous of men by the newspaper he founded, the New York Evening Post. His huge New York funeral, concluding with his burial at Trinity Church at Broadway and Wall Street in Lower Manhattan, was a spectacular occasion. With the presidential election coming in the autumn, Jefferson likely believed a dignified silence, or at least silence he hoped would be seen as dignified rather than callous, was the best course. In the heat of the summer of 1804, praise of Hamilton was interpreted not as the elegant reaction to a shocking and untimely death, but as an endorsement of his program and a condemnation of his opponents. John Adams saw this, later writing Jefferson that Hamilton's partisans had seized the moment of public feeling to come forward with funeral orations and printed panegyrics. And why? Merely to disgrace the old Whigs and keep the funds and banks in countenance. To Jefferson, Hamilton had represented the most dangerous of tendencies. As president, however, Jefferson did little to destroy the system Hamilton had built. We had indeed no personal dissensions, Jefferson later said of Hamilton. Each of us perhaps thought well of the other as a man, but as politicians it was impossible for two men to be of more opposite principles. The more pressing issue was Burr, who was indicted for murder, both by a coroner's jury in New York and by a grand jury in New Jersey. The vice president escaped both states in late July. For Jefferson, the problem of Aaron Burr was just beginning, for on Monday, August 6, 1804, not quite a month after Hamilton's death, Anthony Mary told London that Burr wanted to effect a separation of the western part of the United States from that which lies between the Atlantic and the mountains, in its whole extent. As president, Jefferson found it useful to be aware of what the opposition was saying and doing. Behind the scenes, he was a shrewd consumer of newspaper and political intelligence. Reading the enemy journals, Jefferson found inspiration for and detected perils to a possible second term. I sincerely regret that the unbounded calumnies of the Federal Party have obliged me to throw myself on the verdict of my country for trial, my great desire having been to retire at the end of the present term to a life of tranquility. And it was my decided purpose when I entered into office, he wrote Eldridge Gerry in 1804. They force my continuance. George Clinton replaced Burr as the Republican candidate for vice president in the 1804 election. A New Yorker, Clinton was the child of Irish immigrants, and his rise to power presaged much of the story of American politics. Clinton's family and connections do not entitle him to so distinguished a preeminence, John Jay had once written of him. That was a strongly Federalist view. The Jeffersonian view was different, allowing for social and political mobility among whites. The Federalists fielded Charles Cotesworth Pinckney, who had been John Adams' vice presidential candidate 4 years before. Any challenge to the incumbent was an honorable but hopeless cause. Jefferson's popularity, based on lower taxes, significant prosperity, and the Louisiana Purchase, was secure. The president was re-elected decisively, carrying 162 electoral votes to Pinckney's 14. Once so dominant, the Federalist enterprise was failing. Writing from Philadelphia in December 1804, a correspondent signing himself a friend of the Constitution told Jefferson that there is a plot formed to murder you. A band of hardy fellows have joined to do it. They are to have $10,000 if they succeed in the attempt. They are to carry daggers and pistols. I have been invited to join them, but would rather suffer death. I advise you to take care and be cautious how you walk about, as some of the assassins are already in Washington. The virulence of such threats belied the larger reality in the country. The power of the administration rests upon the support of a much stronger majority of the people throughout the Union than the former administrations ever possessed since the first establishment of the Constitution, John Quincy Adams said in the wake of Jefferson's victory. The political faith of Adams' own father was doomed. What lived and ruled was quintessentially Jeffersonian. The vibrant, breathing, prevailing politics of the hour reflected the complicated character of the triumphant president. The America of Jefferson was neither wholly federal nor wholly republican. It was, rather, a marbled blend of the two, confected by a practical man of affairs. The significance of the case of Louisiana in shaping the destinies of the country and in illuminating Jefferson's political leadership cannot be overstated. He believed, for instance, in a limited government, except when he thought the nation was best served by a more expansive one. It was a moment to savor success. The capital was quiet. "We have but few strangers in town," Jefferson wrote Patsy on Monday, January 7, 1805. His second inaugural at hand, Jefferson's thoughts drifted back over the trials he and his compatriots had faced in the past 40 years. "We entered young into the first revolution and saw it terminate happily," Jefferson wrote the New Hampshire statesman John Langdon. "We had to engage when old in a second more perilous, because our people were divided. But we have weathered this too, and seen all come round, and to rights." Yet even in victory, Jefferson felt the weight of expectation. He knew political serenity never lasted. In December 1804, the Federalist Senator William Plumer had been invited to dine with Jefferson. The president was dressed well, a new suit of black, silk hose, shoes, clean linen, and his hair highly powdered. And the company ate well. His dinner was elegant and rich. To Plumer, though, Jefferson did not seem a man at the height of his political fortunes. He was today reserved, appeared rather low-spirited, conversed little, Plumer wrote in his diary. The president had much on his mind. It was the age of Napoleon and Nelson, of contending powers who seemed never truly at peace, and America remained a target for the designs of enemies determined to dominate all or part of it. His final 4 years in public office were like the previous decades. Jefferson still struggled to secure the nation. It began, but hardly ended, with Britain, which still harbored doubts about the wherewithal of the United States. We drove them into being a nation when they were no more fit for it than the convicts of Botany Bay, the British diplomat Augustus Foster wrote his mother in 1805. On Saturday, March 2, 1805, Vice President Burr took his leave of the Capitol with a paean to the Senate, which he called a sanctuary, a citadel of law, of order, and of liberty. And it is here in this exalted refuge, here, if anywhere, will resistance be made to the storms of popular frenzy and the silent arts of corruption. And if the Constitution be destined ever to perish by the sacrilegious hands of a demagogue or the usurper, which, God avert, its expiring agonies will be witnessed on this floor. William Plumer thought Burr was finished in political life, then thought again. He can never, I think, rise again, Plumer wrote in his diary. But surely he is a very extraordinary man, and is an exception to all rules. Plumer could not yet know how close to the mark he was. All is now business, hurry, interruption, Jefferson said on the eve of his second inauguration. His political dominance over the nation was a given. In a private letter, Augustus Foster referred to him sarcastically as the successor of Montezuma, an allusion to the 16th-century Aztec god-king, but the irony was a tribute to Jefferson's power. Jefferson's second inauguration fell on a Monday. He dressed in black and left the grounds of the president's house on horseback. In the Senate chamber, again speaking too softly to be widely heard, Jefferson gave his second inaugural address. During this course of administration, and in order to disturb it, the artillery of the press has been leveled against us, charged with whatsoever its licentiousness could devise or dare, he said. These abuses of an institution so important to freedom and science are deeply to be regretted, inasmuch as they tend to lessen its usefulness and to sap its safety. The marketplace, however, should decide. Censorship should be in the hands of the people. Afterward, Jefferson opened the president's house to callers. It, too, was run according to pell-mell, and Foster, who made his way down Pennsylvania Avenue to the celebration, reported that all who chose attended, and, even towards the close, blacks and dirty boys who drunk his wine and lolled upon his couches before us all. Some music capped the day, Foster noted, a few pipes and drums, and the festivities, such as they were, came to a close. Jefferson was now the second two-term president of the United States. As he returned to greet the public, even the blacks and dirty boys of Foster's formulation, he had every intention of following Washington's example and retiring in 4 years' time. Only one contingency could tempt him to a third election, a contingency he mentioned to John Taylor of Caroline in early 1805. My opinion originally was that the president of the U.S. should have been elected for 7 years, and forever ineligible afterwards. Now he was not so sure. I've since become sensible that 7 years is too long to be unremovable, and that there should be a peaceable way of withdrawing a man in midway who is doing wrong. The service for 8 years, with a power to remove at the end of the first four, comes nearly to my principle as corrected by experience. And it is in adherence to that that I determined to withdraw at the end of my second term. The danger is that the indulgence and attachments of the people will keep a man in the chair after he becomes a dotard, that re-election through life shall become habitual, and election for life follow that. General Washington set the example of voluntary retirement after 8 years. I shall follow it, and a few more precedents will oppose the obstacle of habit to anyone after a while who shall endeavor to extend his term. Perhaps it may beget a disposition to establish it by an amendment of the Constitution. There is, however, but one circumstance which could engage my acquiescence in another election, to wit, such a division about a successor as might bring in a monarchist. But this circumstance is impossible. Visions of a crown worried him still. In the spring of 1805, the first fruits of the Lewis and Clark expedition started coming east. It being the wish of Captain Lewis, I take the liberty to send you, for your own perusal, the notes which I have taken in the form of a journal in their original state. William Clark wrote Jefferson in April. Briefing Jefferson, Meriwether Lewis wrote, "I can foresee no material or probable obstruction to our progress, and entertain therefore the most sanguine hopes of complete success." From Fort Mandan, the expedition's winter encampment on the Missouri River in North Dakota, the two leaders sent Jefferson a collection of artifacts. There was a box with the skins and skeletons of antelope and weasels and wolves. There were elk horns. There were scores of plants and four living magpies. For Jefferson, it was a joyous delivery. Accounts of Lewis and Clark fascinated the public. The voyage of discovery of Captain Lewis has engaged the attention of the curious and attracted the notice of many who were prejudiced against that country, wrote William Eustace from Massachusetts in August 1805. This nation was never more respected abroad. The people were never more happy at home. In late 1805, on a tree overlooking the Pacific, after a journey of more than 3,000 miles, Clark staked the claim Jefferson had long dreamed of. Captain William Clark, December 3, 1805. By land, you states in 1804 and 1805. A mission conceived on the Potomac had culminated on the Pacific. It was a staggering achievement, a Jeffersonian projection of power to find a path through the wilderness and to master a continent. Jefferson delighted in receiving things from the West and the East. From London, he ordered an 8-volume edition of Baxter's History of England, copies of essays on brewing, geometry and astronomy, and maps of Europe, Asia, Africa, and South America. He wanted a telescope, too, and a pair of British globes, with the new discoveries to 1800. It all fit. In his years in office, he turned the presidency and the president's house into something it had not been before, a center of curiosity and inquiry. A vibrant institution that played informal but important roles in the broader life of the nation, from science to literature. Jefferson set aside a room in the mansion for fossils. There were pieces of skulls, jawbones and teeth, tusks and a foreleg, one horn of a colossal animal, and 200 small bones collected by William Clark. The bones are spread in a large room where you can work at your leisure, undisturbed by any mortal from morning to night, taking your breakfast and dinner with us, he wrote Caspar Wister, Jr., the Philadelphia physician who later published A System of Anatomy. The explorer Zebulon Pike purchased 2 bear cubs for Jefferson from an Indian along the Rio Grande. His men nursed them with milk, and they arrived safely at the president's house in 1808. I would recommend, if practicable, that they should be confined together in a cell without chains, and regularly supplied with food and water, when I am nearly convinced that they will harmonize and become much more docile than if chained and confined asunder, Pike told the president. Jefferson took Pike's advice. I put them together while here in a place 10 foot square, Jefferson wrote the naturalist and painter Charles Wilson Peel. For the first day they worried one another very much with play, but after that they played at times, but were extremely happy together. Unsurprisingly, it proved impractical to keep bears at the president's house, and Jefferson sent them to Peel's Zoo in Philadelphia. Considering a request from a man seeking counsel on determining whether a stone had been a meteor, Jefferson said, "We certainly are not to deny whatever we cannot account for." He was not always as skeptical as he ought to have been. He could be hopelessly wrong about scientific matters. Alluding to the maneuvering between Madison and Monroe for the presidential succession, Timothy Pickering said that while the Republicans fought for 1808, the actual president is exploring the wilds of Louisiana, its salt plains, its rock or mineral salt, its immense prairies, in which he has discovered the earthly paradise, its numerous tribes and remnants of tribes of Indians, and how many languages they speak, the hot springs and the warm mud puddles in their vicinity, and the wonderful phenomena in one of a small or very minute shellfish in shape resembling a mussel, but having four legs, and in another, a vermes about half an inch long, moving with a serpentine or vermicular motion. Jefferson could be prideful about his passions. A jealous sense of praise and censure are among the most striking features of Mr. Jefferson's character, and his gratitude for the former is in exact proportion to his implacable resentment against the latter, wrote the British diplomat Edward Thornton. Jefferson, Thornton said, is well placed to be considered as an able statesman, but he is still more proud of being thought to combine a capacity for public affairs with the abstraction necessary for scientific pursuit. The British even attributed some of Jefferson's long-standing hostility toward London to the French cultivation of his love of science and letters. I really believe that the little account made in England of his literary talents at an early period added considerably to the bitterness which other causes had excited in his mind against her, Thornton wrote. The French, under the monarchy at least, seem to have understood better this part of his character, and they gained his heart by associating him in their literary societies. Still, his curiosity was perennial. "Will you come and take an Indian dinner with us tomorrow?" Jefferson wrote John Breckinridge in March 1806. "There is one of the chiefs who is really a curiosity, as possessing the art of speaking by signs, of which we have often heard, but never before seen an example. The hour, as usual, half after 3. With William Dunlap, the playwright and painter, Jefferson shared notes on the croaking of frogs in Washington, the early approach of spring, of gardening, French and English, preferring the latter, and praising their great taste in laying out their ground. With Samuel and Margaret Bayard Smith, over tea in the president's house, Jefferson spoke of agriculture, gardening, the differences of both in different countries, and of the produce of different climates. He sent Mrs. Smith home with winter melon seed from Malta. The subject did not matter. He was forever working over political and philosophical problems. "What would you think of raising a force for the defense of New Orleans in this manner?" Jefferson wrote to Madison, Gallatin, and Dearborn in February 1806. "Give a bounty of 50 acres of land to be delivered immediately to every able-bodied man who will immediately settle on it and hold himself in readiness to perform 2 years military service, on the usual pay, if called on within the first 7 years of his residence." He was always ready with suggestions for the young. "I would advise him to read Livy, Tacitus, and Horace this summer," he wrote to a friend with a son. "The two former will give him a good knowledge of the Roman history, while they instruct him in the language. He may at the same time read Anacharsis in French, which will strengthen his knowledge of that language and possess him of the Grecian history. I would advise him to read, too, Baxter's History of England as a corrective of Hume, which he has read. Indeed, it is Hume republicanized." Much of the nation's political energy in 1805 was devoted to dealing with tensions with Spain over the exact boundaries of the Louisiana Territory, the fate of the Floridas, which Madrid declined to hand over, and financial claims. Spain remained a presence in North America, and it was allied with France. A mission of Monroe's to the Spanish capital failed, giving rise to a debate within the Jefferson administration about the use of force against Spanish posts and holdings. Should the United States risk a broader war against Spain and France by taking a strong stand? In such a case, would it make sense for America to make common cause with England, which wanted allies against Napoleon, thus turning London, a potential enemy, into a friend, at least for the time being? Jefferson's ultimate answer was no. Despite exploring the possibilities of a provisional treaty with Britain that would have created an alliance in the event of an American war with Spain or France, Jefferson decided that neutrality was still the country's best course. "Our Constitution is a peace establishment. It is not calculated for war," Jefferson said. war would endanger its existence. In Jefferson's reading of history, war was about armies and navies and debt and honors, all of which had played their part in the fall of republics and the rise of empires. Yet occasionally one had to fight to preserve liberty. Jefferson knew this, and he recognized that combat, though a last resort, was still a resort. The man who had been hunted by Tarleton would use every other weapon he could think of before projecting American military force. Measures short of traditional warfare, the fortification of harbors with cannons, the building of gunboats for coastal defense, and the preparation of the militia for possible deployment, were to be aggressively pursued, and Jefferson called for all of these in his annual message to Congress at the end of 1805. As the year drew to a close, Jefferson saw foes wherever he looked. The British, and to a lesser extent the French, were harassing American ships. Napoleon won a glorious victory at Austerlitz. Nelson had died a hero's death in his triumph at Trafalgar. Closest to home, Burr, the old vice president, was allegedly plotting against the United States. Thinking of France and England, Jefferson tried to make the best of a troubling hour. "What an awful spectacle does the world exhibit at this instant," Jefferson wrote in January 1806. "Our wish ought to be that he who has armies may not have the dominion of the sea, and that he who has dominion of the sea may be one who has no armies. In this way we may be quiet, at home at least." Jefferson had to face the inevitable question. How long would the quiet last? How long could it last? Chapter 37. A Deep, Dark, and Widespread Conspiracy. The designs of our Catiline are as real as they are romantic. Thomas Jefferson on Aaron Burr's Western Maneuvers. Jefferson's winter was brightened by Patsy's family's long stay in the president's house, where his only surviving daughter from his marriage gave birth to a grandson, James Madison Randolph, named in honor of the grandfather, Secretary of State. Dolly Madison had helped Patsy prepare for the season, acquiring a fashionable wig, a set of combs for dressing the hair, a bonnet, shawl, and white lace veil from Baltimore, as well as two lace half-handkerchiefs. The president also took a moment to tend to his cellar in Washington, checking to make sure he had sufficient Bordeaux, he did, but sending for some additional sparkling wines, he thought his current holdings dry without any softness. On Capitol Hill, though, a cousin brought whatever serenity Jefferson was enjoying to an end. Once an ally, always an eccentric, John Randolph of Roanoke broke with Jefferson in March 1806. The year before, Randolph had stopped a Jefferson-sponsored compromise settlement of a long-standing dispute involving the Yazoo land companies. A corrupt Georgia legislature had sold lands rightly belonging to the Creeks, creating a speculative market. That episode was a prelude to Randolph's more decisive move into opposition. The new occasion was debate over resolutions to limit or even ban British imports in retaliation for British depredations against American shipping. On the floor of the House, Randolph declared war on the administration. William Plumer left the Senate chamber that day to go to the House to hear him. He considered Great Britain as now contending for her existence, as fighting the battles of the civilized world against Bonaparte, who is usurping the dominion of the world, Plumer wrote of Randolph's speech. Randolph singled out Jefferson and Madison for particular assault. "It was the most bitter, severe, and eloquent philippic I ever heard," wrote Plumer. Randolph struck again the next day and was, Plumer said, uncommonly severe on the president. "Mr. Randolph has passed the Rubicon. Neither the president or secretary of state can, after this, be on terms with him. He has set them and their measures at defiance." Cutting and sarcastic, Randolph seemed to spare no one. A colleague who rose to speak was waved away. "Sit down, sir. I say sit down, sir. Learn to keep your proper level," Randolph said. On the subject of the president himself, Randolph astonished all his hearers by the boldness of his animadversions on executive conduct, wrote Senator Samuel Smith of Maryland. Eventually known as either the Quids, after tertium quid, which in Latin means a third something, or the old Republicans, Randolph's faction was a manifestation of purer, simpler Republican principles. Randolph's followers held that Jefferson had moved too far in a Federalist direction, and that they, not the president or his men, were the true believers. The break was in some ways a sign that Jefferson had transcended the simpler rhetorical categories of the post-1798 period. It was easy to speak theoretically and idealistically about politics when one is seeking power. The demands of exercising it once it is won, however, are so complex and fluid that ideological certitude is often among the first casualties of actual governing. Jefferson had achieved something that his Federalist foes would not have thought possible. He was, to some, no longer Republican enough. Jefferson was, in other words, a man who had displeased the extremes of his day, a sign that he had been guided not by dogma, but by principled pragmatism. The president was indeed considering projections of power that would have broadened the role of the public sector beyond the strict confines favored by some believers in limited government. Jefferson was the first president to advocate a broad program of public works, calling for a constitutional amendment to authorize the financing of education, roads, rivers, canals, and other projects. By these operations, he said in his sixth annual message, new channels of communication will be opened between the states. The lines of separation will disappear. Their interests will be identified, and their union cemented by new and indissoluble ties. Later in the spring of 1808, Secretary of the Treasury Albert Gallatin delivered a landmark report proposing $20 million in infrastructure improvements to roads and canals. Due to the fiscal strains during the embargo and rising tensions with England, and believing himself without the constitutional authority, Jefferson was unable to realize this ambitious program, but nearly every project that Gallatin outlined was eventually completed. The first of these was the federally sponsored Cumberland, or National Road, running west from Maryland, and in time, reaching Illinois. As Randolph saw it, Jefferson's largely moderate politics was a path to disaster. Never, in my opinion, had the cause of free government more to fear than now, Randolph wrote in 1806. Republicans loyal to the president had become secret enemies or lukewarm advocates of the cause of republicanism, damning with faint praise the principles they had sworn to support. Melodramatically, Randolph asked, "Is the present executive perfect? Amidst the various agents of that department, has there been or can there be no wrong committed?" To Randolph, the answer was self-evident. Jefferson had proved too much of a compromiser. Moderation, Randolph said, was the mask which ambition has worn through the ages. By the last year of the president's term, Randolph would tell James Monroe, "The old Republican Party is already ruined, past redemption." Jefferson affected an air of calm about the events of the current session, but the telltale headache was back, suggesting the Republican split and the complications of the European situation, which included the possibility of an American war, weighed heavily. In late April 1806 in New York, the HMS Leander was screening American ships in search of British seamen. Firing a warning shot, the Leander mistakenly killed an American sailor. Two other British ships, the Driver and the Cambrian, were nearby. Ordering the three ships out of U.S. waters, Jefferson called for the arrest of the Leander captain for murder. His headache was debilitating. "My present malady keeps me through the whole day incapable of business or conversation," Jefferson wrote the Pennsylvania Senator George Logan. Jefferson could stand face-to-face meetings only in the evenings, when the pain seems to have ebbed. He was suffering pain in his leg, too. He called it a lameness in the knee. And he was worried about money. "I have gotten so into arrears at Washington as to render it necessary for me not only to avoid new engagements, but to suspend every expense which is not indispensable. Otherwise I shall leave that place with burdens contracted there, which, if they should fall on my private fortune, will doom me to a comfortless old age," Jefferson wrote John Wales Epps in May 1806. He lost his oldest mentor in early summer. George Wythe had risen as usual on Sunday, May 25, 1806, and eaten breakfast at home. At around 9 o'clock that morning he was sick to his stomach. The rest of his household was stricken, too. One member, a mixed-race teenager named Michael Brown, died a few days later. William Duval, a magistrate, was suspicious and ordered an autopsy. Four physicians attended, and Duval told Jefferson, "From the inflammation on the stomach and bowels, they said that it was the kind of inflammation produced by poison." The culprit was presumably George Sweeney, a Wythe grandnephew whose motives, if he did it, may have included jealousy and money. "I am murdered," Wythe said on May 25, 1806, but Duval reported that Wythe mentioned no name. As he faded, he said, "Let me die righteous." It was a sensational story, one that raised interesting questions about George Wythe's private life. Married twice and now widowed, Wythe lived in Williamsburg with young Michael Brown and with his housekeeper, Lydia Broadnax, a free woman of color. In Wythe's will, Broadnax was to inherit the Wythe house, among other property, and Wythe had included provisions asking Jefferson to oversee the education of Michael Brown in the event of Wythe's death. The implications of these arrangements, that Brown was the son of Broadnax and Wythe, are clear but unproven. Whether Brown, who was described as yellow-skinned, was his biological son or not, Wythe treated him as if he were, taking pains with his education, wrote the historian Annette Gordon Reed. Certainly asking his own favorite and most famous pupil, the current President of the United States, to become Michael's guardian, shows the depth of his affection for the boy. Wythe left Jefferson, whom he had loved, his books, silver cups, and a gold-headed cane. The crime disturbed and distressed the President, who told Duval that he would have happily taken on the education of Michael Brown. "The task," he said, "would have gratified me unceasingly, with the constant recollection and execution of the wishes of my friend." Did Jefferson believe Michael Brown to be the son of his old teacher? If so, what emotions would news of the alleged murder of his mentor by a disgruntled member of Wythe's white family have stirred up in Jefferson, who knew much about the living of such a life? We do not know, but it is interesting that Jefferson sought to understand the story as a severe aberration, not as something that could happen in the ordinary course of life. Such an instance of depravity has been hitherto known to us only in the fables of the poets, Jefferson wrote Duval in June 1806. The more imaginative distance Jefferson could put between himself and Wythe's fate, the better. In the summer, there was something new, a debilitating drought in Virginia, and in the autumn, something by now familiar, reports that Aaron Burr was making trouble. Since the duel with Hamilton, Burr had set out on a wanderjahr. He traveled west, and rumors had him variously plotting to convince some states to secede and form a Western Empire, or planning an independent strike into Mexico. The most fevered speculation carried matters even further by suggesting that Burr was contemplating raising troops to march on Washington and take over the United States. "Burr is unquestionably very actively engaged in the westward in preparations to sever that from this part of the Union," Jefferson wrote in November 1806. The former vice president was allegedly recruiting men, stocking arms, and building boats. Jefferson heard nothing to alleviate his concerns. "This is indeed a deep, dark, and widespread conspiracy," the American general James Wilkinson wrote Jefferson in November. "Embracing the young and the old, the Democrat and the Federalist, the native and the foreigner, the patriot of 76 and the exotic of yesterday, the opulent and the needy, the ins and the outs, and I fear it will receive strong support in New Orleans." Wilkinson himself was trouble. An officer long in the pay of the Spanish, he was a scoundrel of the First Order, and had been in conversations with Burr about possible plots. At some point, Wilkinson decided it was in his interest to inform Jefferson of Burr's alleged treachery, thus saving himself for another day. By November 27, 1806, Jefferson was worried enough to issue a proclamation warning that sundry persons, including citizens of the United States, were conspiring and confederating together to take over Spanish holdings. What was Burr doing? It is not certain even now, more than two centuries later. At first, he seemed interested in a military venture to seize control of Texas and other parts of Spanish America. Such an operation was known as a filibuster, an independent strike. Burr and his sundry compatriots seemed to be preparing for an expedition of some kind. The goal was unclear, except that Jefferson believed it involved Burr assuming power and land in the West, possibly as far south as Mexico, and perhaps forming an empire of his own. On Saturday, December 27, 1806, New Hampshire Senator William Plumer dined with Jefferson, who, over coffee, said he believed all would be well. Jefferson, Plumer said, had no doubt the conspiracy would be crushed, extensive as it was, with little trouble and expense to the United States. Incriminating papers soon emerged, and Jefferson forwarded them to Congress in January 1807. In the meantime, Jefferson was seeking sufficient power to deal with any domestic crisis. 8 days before his chat with Plumer, Jefferson had drafted a bill authorizing the employment of the land or naval forces of the U.S. in cases of insurrection. He sent the proposed legislation to Virginia Congressman John Dawson with this revealing note. Thomas Jefferson presents his compliments to Mr. Dawson and his request that he will be so good as to copy the within and burn this original, as he is very unwilling to meddle personally with the details of the proceedings of the legislature. This was the pure political Jefferson, fighting to defend the nation by asking for a grant of power while disguising his own role in the acquisition of that authority. His adversaries might see such maneuvers as hypocritical or underhanded, but in Jefferson's mind he was doing the right thing the right way. To seize power grandly would threaten the democratic ethos of the country, an ethos he thought essential. Better to work through allies in Congress, he thought, than to risk appearing monarchical, even if the control he sought was the kind a Federalist president might want, too. It was the method of a practical man. Jefferson pursued Burr unapologetically. He did so less out of personal ambition or jealousy. Since the killing of Hamilton, Burr could pose no threat within the traditional political system, than out of his concern for the security and sanctity of the nation. As in the case of Louisiana, the cause of preserving the Union was more important than what Jefferson called the strict line of the law. In his report on Burr to Congress on Thursday, January 22, 1807, Jefferson took the extraordinary step of declaring that his former vice president's guilt is placed beyond question, a decision not unlike the ones he had made long ago in the Josiah Phillips case and in the arrest of the hair buyer general. If the liberties of the suspects, including Burr, were violated then, so be it. By late March 1807, Burr was under arrest. Jefferson paid careful attention to the proceedings. "No man's history proves better the value of honesty," Jefferson wrote. With that, what might he not have been? "Unfortunately, his headache," he said, "leaves me but an hour and a half each morning capable of any business at all." Burr was brought to Richmond for trial, where John Marshall presided over a courtroom set up in the Eagle Tavern. Jefferson took an obsessive interest in the case, gathering information and advising the prosecution counsel. He believed serious issues were at stake, and characteristically threw himself into the matter in detail, but at a distance. Though Burr was indicted for treason, the weaknesses of the case against him grew evident as the trial progressed. Co-conspirator-turned-prosecution witness James Wilkinson had charged that Burr intended to capture New Orleans, an allegation that had led Jefferson to declare martial law there to defend against any treachery, and to lead an attack on Spanish holdings, a problematic allegation since filibusters were not illegal. The messenger from Richmond rode up Jefferson's mountain in darkness. The vacationing president was still awake, and he perused the communication and its enclosure with care. It was no ordinary delivery. U.S. Attorney George Hay, the prosecutor in the Burr case, was subpoenaing the president to testify at the trial in person. After consulting with Madison, a house guest at Monticello, Jefferson refused to submit himself and his office to the control of others. Writing Hay the next day, he said, "As I do not believe that the district courts have a power of commanding the executive government to abandon superior duties and attend on them at whatever distance, I am unwilling by any notice of the subpoena to set a precedent which might sanction a proceeding so preposterous." Jefferson's decision to reserve unto himself the authority to decide whether to obey a summons to testify set a significant precedent in executive power. The president, Jefferson was saying, had higher obligations to the common good than to answer the importunings of the legal system. He would, instead, send Hay relevant documents, a wise compromise that prevented a president from holding himself above the law, but preserved his ability to do his job without being forced to travel at the command of distant courts. He enclosed the subpoena to Hay and dispatched it whence it had come. Marshall's decisions and demeanor as the trial judge exacerbated matters for Jefferson, who tended to ascribe any setback for the prosecution to the Chief Justice's politics. The proceedings in Virginia joined the repeal of the Judiciary Act of 1801, the reaction to Marbury, and the impeachment of Samuel Chase as a front in Jefferson's long struggle against the judicial system that he disliked and distrusted more and more as the years passed. Burr's eventual acquittal enraged the president. In truth, the evidence on the treason charge against the defendant was weak. Jefferson, nevertheless, hoped that the country would join him in seeing the hand of Marshall as the decisive force in thwarting the prosecution. "The nation will judge both the offender and judges for themselves," Jefferson wrote William Branch Giles. "If a member of the executive or legislature does wrong, the day is never far distant when the people will remove him." Perhaps, Jefferson thought, outrage over the Burr verdict could be channeled into a constitutional amendment making judges more accountable to the public. He had been miserable for a week. "I am now in the seventh day of a periodical headache, and I write this in the morning before the fit has come on," he wrote Patsy in March 1807. "The fits are by no means as severe as I have felt in former times, but they hold me very long, from 9 or 10 in the morning till dark. Neither calomel nor bark has as yet made the least impression on them." There were also the usual complaints and stresses. "I am tired of an office where I can do no more good than many others who would be glad to be employed in it," he wrote his old revolutionary colleague John Dickinson in early 1807. "To myself, personally, it brings nothing but unceasing drudgery and daily loss of friends." In this period, a proposed treaty with Britain arrived in Washington. It did little for American interests. The British commissioners appear to have screwed every article as far as it would bear to have taken everything and yielded nothing, Jefferson wrote of the treaty in March 1807. Diplomacy, in short, had not resolved conflict with Britain, particularly in terms of stopping the humiliating impressment of American seamen. Jefferson refused to send it to the Senate. In February 1807, in a passing conversation with his sons-in-law, Jefferson invited John Wales Epps to join him on some occasion, the details are unknown, but did not include Thomas Mann Randolph, Jr. The slight, however unintentional, at once enraged and depressed Randolph, who wrote Jefferson an emotional letter, complaining that the president favored Epps, whom Randolph envied and saw as an all-too-successful rival for the affections and attentions of their father-in-law. Jefferson was taken aback by the complaints. He had, he said, detected some tension between the two congressmen who had married daughters of his, but, typically for Jefferson, he had chosen not to inquire about the unease. Avoiding overt conflict was a Jeffersonian specialty. "What acts of mine can have induced you to suppose that I felt or manifested a preference for Epps, I cannot conceive," Jefferson soothingly wrote Randolph. In his apparent anger and anguish, Randolph had moved out of the president's house. "Your return to the house would indeed be a consolation to me," wrote Jefferson, who could not take his mind off the question. "Really loving you as I would a son, for I protest I know no difference, I took it too much for granted you were as sensible of it as myself," he said in a second note on February 19, 1807. Randolph, who had decided not to stand for re-election to Congress, fell ill in his new lodgings, and Jefferson dispatched a retainer to keep watch over his condition. Jefferson's paternal feelings toward Randolph were genuine. I certainly would not urge anything that would be strongly repugnant to your feelings, but I wish, my dear sir, you could consent to return to your former room here, Jefferson wrote Randolph on February 28th. Randolph did come back, but he was very sick and very depressed. He mused about suicide. Jefferson kept track of the number of paces the recuperating Randolph was able to walk in the circular room on the second floor of the president's house, 500 or 600 steps the first day he tried, 1,200 the next, and wrote Patsy frequent optimistic reports. Domestic harmony mattered as much to him as political harmony did. Chapter 38. This Damned Embargo. Never since the Battle of Lexington have I seen this country in such a state of exasperation as at present, and even that did not produce such unanimity. Thomas Jefferson, on the British attack on the USS Chesapeake. In Washington, Jefferson was on war footing. Something now occurs almost every day on which it is desirable to have the opinions of the heads of departments, Jefferson wrote Treasury Secretary Albert Gallatin in July 1807. The members of the cabinet were to feel free, Jefferson said, to call on me at any moment of the day which suits their separate convenience. The precipitating crisis was a Monday, June 22, 1807 attack on the USS Chesapeake by the HMS Leopard in the waters off Cape Henry on the Virginia coast. The British ship had ordered the American one to allow it to search the Chesapeake for deserters. The commanding officer of the Chesapeake, James Barron, refused, at which point the Leopard opened fire on the American frigate. 22 shots struck the Chesapeake before the Americans managed to get off a single rejoinder. Barron and 17 others were wounded. 3 men were killed. It was an act of war, an insult, too, and an attack on the United States of America. The public reaction was swift. After I had read the information of the outrageous attack on the Chesapeake, I felt as every true American should feel, indignation and resentment at the British, a correspondent wrote Jefferson from Philadelphia on Monday, June 29th. Jefferson instantly summoned the cabinet. Gallatin was away in Maryland. I am sorry to be obliged to hasten your return, Jefferson wrote him, and pray it may be without a moment's avoidable delay. Gallatin was sick